This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a scholar of Native American and Black U.S. ancestry finds a path to greater unity among the two groups in hip-hop. Pan-Africanists from the United States and elsewhere in the diaspora make common cause with townspeople in Sierra Leone, West Africa. And what role did the CIA play in the election of a fascist as president of Brazil?
But first, an educator who has long studied policing in the United States says efforts to curb law enforcement abuse of Black communities are largely misdirected. Alex Vitale is a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and coordinator of the College Policing and Social Justice Project. Vitale is author of the new book, The End of Policing. He says attempts to reform the police simply won't work.
I've spent over 25 years working on policing issues in a variety of contexts, and during that time, I've seen exactly these kinds of patterns of outrageous police behavior, community outrage and response that tends to generate the same sort of list of demands. You know, indict the officer, bring in community policing, do some special training, hire a few more Black and Latino police officers. And I would just say to your listeners there, show me the American city where Black and brown folks are happy with the policing that emerges after a round of this kind of reform. I don't think there is one. We don't have really any evidence to support the kinds of reforms that people have often called for out of, you know, tremendous frustration and totally legitimate grievances. And my view is that instead, we need to focus on why we have turned every social problem in our society over to the police to handle, and that so many of the deeply problematic interactions between the police and communities of color are driven by the war on drugs and broken windows policing and the management of people having mental health crises, all of which should just be taken out of their hands.
Yes, we hear a lot about police training, but we've seen police training centralized and nationalized and become very intensive. And in fact, the police training that the federal government has in many ways supervised appears to many of us to be the problem. Police have been trained to be more repressive, more prone to respond with deadly force.
Well, that's certainly true historically of a lot of police training, and I go through some of that history in the book. But even the more so-called enlightenment training that's come out of the Obama Justice Department and is sort of contained in this report on 21st century policing that they did is, in my mind, really misguided. It mostly revolves around a series of what we call procedural reforms, fixing paperwork, getting the police to act in a more professional and unbiased manner, which sounds good on its face, but a totally lawful, professional, unbiased, low-level drug arrest is still going to ruin some young person's life for no good reason. And we don't need so many things that the police do to be more professional. We just need them to quit doing it. And instead, invest in the real kinds of problem solvings that communities need. Drug treatment on demand, restorative justice programs in our schools, real mental health services in the community.
We see, for example, that people respond to horrific statistics, like, for example, Black folks getting arrested at 4 or 5 or even 10 times the rate as whites for marijuana. But you believe that the real problem is that people are getting arrested for marijuana possession at all, and that the police are in control of people's cultural behavior.
That's right. I mean, the idea that the fix to the racial disparities in the drug war is to arrest more white people is totally ludicrous, because that's going to be no more just than the system that we already have. We have to quit turning our problems over to the police to solve, because what tools ultimately do the police have to solve our community problems? They don't have access to jobs. They don't have access to medical services, drug treatment, housing, employment services, high-quality education. These are the kinds of tools we need to solve community problems. And every time we ask the police to be part of that solution, we're empowering an institution that has never acted in the best interests of communities of color. And so one of the big motivations of the book was just to really underline the need to take the anger that emerges about police misconduct and keep it focused on a broader racial and economic justice agenda.
And one response to police abuse of power and police violence is the call for community control of police. Does this open up the discussion in ways that you think are useful?
I'm somewhat skeptical about this. I mean, we don't want a situation, for instance, where every community has control over its police, because what we're going to get then is the fact that the majority of communities are white, and the policing in that community is going to become worse for people of color. So that as they travel to work, travel to school, go shopping, visit people, and travel through white neighborhoods, what we're going to get is more of the kind of Trayvon Martin dynamics, right? Where the community is working with the police to treat all people of color as suspicious and dangerous and will lead to horrible abuses. But also, I don't think gaining some influence over the police is A, possible, and B, is going to lead to any real solutions to the very real problems that communities face. And I think the political capital that goes into these campaigns for community control of the police would be better spent gaining accountability over local elected officials by demanding real solutions to community problems.
Well, describe some of those solutions.
Sure. So, like up in Ithaca, New York, where, guess what, they have a drug problem, like all of America does, the mayor up there said, you know what, I don't think the police are going to really be the solution to our drug problem. So they developed a process of bringing in experts, holding town hall meetings, doing focus groups, and really putting everything on the table. And they came up with what's called the Ithaca Plan, which people can look up, that is a comprehensive approach to the problems of drugs in their community. And guess what? There's nothing about police in there. Drug treatment services, safe injection facilities, needle exchanges, targeted economic development, real public health education. These are the kinds of solutions that are needed. We know, for instance, that community-based anti-violence initiatives that are directed at the young people who are so involved in the violence problem can work when they're well-funded and well-run and don't involve police and courts. The kind of cure violence model, credible messengers. We know solutions to community problems, but we cannot get the politicians to focus on them. They want to turn everything over to the police, and that's a way of defining the problems in our communities as ones of individual and group moral failure that they don't have any responsibility for. But in fact, their economic policies, their austerity measures are directly causing these problems, and they have to be held accountable for that.
But if we're not going to approach this problem from the aspect of community control, how do we inject more democracy into this process, including democracy in terms of the protest?
I'm for community control. I just don't think it should be focused on the police. It's not to say that the police should get a pass. It's that we need to be strategic about the use of our political resources. And I think building real community-based movements that are about broad political accountability will shape the way policing occurs. But it can't be just reduced to this question of control of the police, because if we don't also build credible mechanisms for addressing community problems, there will always be people in the community who will demand police solutions. So we can't just have community control over a police force with no improvement in our housing, employment, and healthcare services in the community.
So instead of constantly raising the question of how police can do a better job, you'd like folks to rethink the whole purpose of police and the idea that having more police or better police or more sensitive police somehow equals more community safety.
Yeah, I'm just very skeptical after 25 years of working on policing issues that we're going to get friendlier, more respectful policing. That there's really, it's just not the nature of the job. Maybe if we can get rid of the war on drugs and the war on crime and the war on gangs and the war on disorder and the war on terrorism, then maybe we could talk about trying to change policing more in terms of its style, its respect of people. But when the political mission that's set for policing is so broad, so invasive, so confrontational, the police cannot be friendly. And the fact that politicians come to us and say the solution to everything that we're angry about is some anti-bias training and de-escalation training just to me sounds ludicrous, and it's a way of them avoiding any responsibility.
And yes, the political powers that be have introduced the conversation with the word war, at least since the 1960s. That sets the stage for, well, I guess, what we've seen.
That's right. I mean, you know, the police did not invent the war on drugs. Many of them are happy to carry it out, but also many of them see the utter futility of it. We've got to hold our elected officials accountable for this. And unfortunately, we also have to do more political education work at the grassroots level to lay out to people the possibilities of a non-police-based solution to this. You know, for 40 years, our communities have been told the only resource we can have from government to solve our problems is more police and longer prison sentences. And that's caused a lot of people to frame their demands in those terms. And I think we could look at like James Forman Jr.'s book, Locking Up Our Own, for examples of how this has played out and how utterly counterproductive it's been. And so we have to do that work at the grassroots level.
Yes, James Forman's book described in detail and documented how demands for more and more police repression, that is, for a solution that results in mass black incarceration, came largely from the black community itself, and even from politicians who were seen as black militants and such.
That's right. So his case study is on Washington, D.C., but other work has been done in New York and other places to show that there is support in communities of color for intensive and aggressive policing. And then they say, but we only want you to get the bad kids, not our kids, like somehow their kids are immune from any of this problematic behavior, or that their kids are not going to get caught in the crossfire, are not going to be treated abusively by massive stop and frisk and buy and bust operations. And this is the contradiction that needs to be addressed.
And what kind of community-based demands do you think should flow from your analysis of the situation that would replace demands for community control of police, or that amorphous thing, more community policing?
I think each community needs to make its own assessment about what the problems are in their community that seem to be dealt with primarily by police. You know, over a quarter and maybe as many as a half of all people killed by police in the United States are having a mental health crisis at the time they're killed. And no amount of mental health training, I think, is going to really fix that. We have to get police out of the business of being the frontline responders to mental health problems in our communities. And that means building up community-based mental health services and non-police crisis response capabilities. Some communities are doing this. Portland, Oregon has created a very good non-police response mechanism to deal with mental health crises, and the police don't end up killing as many people. So communities have to do their own assessments and figure out what they think will work, and then they've got to generate the political pressure to make it happen.
That was Professor Alex Vitale speaking from Brooklyn, New York.
Kyle Mays teaches at the Department of African American Studies and the Native American Center at the University of California in Los Angeles. Mays is author of the new book, Hip Hop Beats, Indigenous Rhymes, Modernity and Hip Hop in North America. He gives equal attention to the histories of both peoples.
Well, I'm actually African-American and Saginaw Chippewa, so my mom is from Cleveland, Ohio, and my dad and family on the Saginaw Chippewa side from Detroit. I grew up in Lansing, Michigan, and for me, the identities have been an essential part of my own development. Often giving talks and meeting people of a similar heritage, they're either of the five tribes, Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw, Seminole, or Creek. And they have a relationship to the history of enslavement and dispossession in the U.S. South and then later Indian Territory, or what is present-day Oklahoma. And they struggle with those heritages. Often it seems as a contradiction. And it, meeting at the intersection of anti-blackness and, I would say, indigenous erasure, I never really had those contradictions. Even though my mom was primarily a single mother, she always made sure that we hung out with our Native relatives, going to powwows, going to the reservation, and just hanging out and being who you are. And so for me, that's the personal idea behind what I've been doing. But the political reason is I don't think we still have yet to give proper attention to the relationship between indigenous dispossession and African enslavement and how that has formed U.S. society. And what that means if we're going to create some form of liberation going forward.
Many, if not most, Black American families can point to some Native American in their ancestry. In fact, some of us believe that much of the Native American population disappeared or was subsumed into Black America.
Yeah, that's a strange way to put it, I think, because one, if we look at the U.S. Census, which doesn't accurately count indigenous peoples in the U.S., it's about 5.2 million according to the 2010 census. But there's also an issue of federal recognition, federally recognized tribes, or state recognized tribes. And the unique thing about Native people is their treaty relationship with the U.S. government that other folks in this country do not have. So they're sovereign states. And they did not disappear. That's often a common thing used, but that's a function of settler colonial society. And what do I mean by settler colonialism is the dispossession of Native people from their lands, because settler colonialism is fundamentally about land, but also the creation of mascots as an example. So you'll see people like the Washington R team with the that particular team, the Cleveland Indians and Chief Wahoo. And settler colonialism is about land, but also about telling the public, even Black folks at times, that Native people have disappeared. So it's really that function And I try to dispel that through my particular work in political activities.
Your book is called Hip Hop Beats, Indigenous Rhymes, Modernity and Hip Hop in North America. And we get it from your book that you think hip hop can be a useful tool in liberation.
Yes. I think what it does is it helps build solidarity between these two communities. So the indigenous artists that I work with and I write about, they share a deep sense of respect for Black culture, Black politics, Black history. And they use hip-hop as an organizing tool to educate indigenous communities, their own communities, but also to coalesce with Black communities. For example, in Detroit, context with which I'm familiar, you have artists like Southeast Anishinaabe, you have artists like Sacramento Knox, Christy B., and they work around issues around water rights. So like the water shutoffs in Detroit, also the Flint water crises. So they are, I would call them cultural workers as well. They're producing music for liberation and coalescing, but they're also actively trying to make sure that Black Lives matter on what we would call Turtle Island, and that there's a future, a shared future between Black and Native peoples.
I created Wrap It Up. That was the first nationally syndicated hip-hop program on commercial radio between 1987 and 1993. But since that time, hip-hop has been swamped by what folks used to call gangster rap, profane, misogynistic material, much of it damn near antisocial. So what's your assessment of the state of hip-hop in the United States and elsewhere in the world?
Yeah, I think there's some element of truth to the sort of turn of hip-hop, but it seems to me, given the context of Black Lives Matter and musicians, although some might still produce this music, but I always like to remind folks that if hip-hop died tomorrow, then misogyny and those other, what you term antisocial elements, would continue. But politics on the ground inform the music that artists often make. And I think Black Lives Matter, founded by three Black women, has sort of led to a resurgence in political music as well. But I think there's a difference between what's on the national radio or on Spotify and streaming services and who gets the most airplay versus those on the ground who are hip-hop DJs, activists, etc., who don't get the same airtime as others who are doing fantastic music and fantastic work. For example, Jaziri X out of Pittsburgh does fantastic work. Macaulay sees they do very cool work in Louisville as a DJ. And so there are radical politics about hip hop on the ground that don't necessarily get the airplay that it deserves in mainstream media.
One of your heroes is W.E.B. Du Bois, but another one is a brother named Charles Eastman. Could you explain the contribution he's made to struggle?
Yeah, so Charles Eastman, he was a Dakota medical doctor, a very prolific writer in the early 20th century. And one of the things I write about the connection between he and W.E.B. Du Bois is that they both went to the Universal Racist Congress in London in 1911 to share to an international audience the struggles of Native peoples in the U.S. and for Du Bois, African-Americans. And Eastman tried his best to demonstrate indigenous humanity through writing, through sharing stories to mostly white audiences. So there were some contradictions that he may have, in fact, played Indian. But I think he was really trying to make sure that people realize Native people are not disappearing, that in fact they had a future and a shared future on the U.S. continent and were in fact human and people who could exist in a modern world. And that, to me, was his major contribution.
Everybody likes to talk about self-determination, although few people are able to describe what self-determination means. But how do we approach issues of self-determination by people who share the same land, different people, both seeking self-determination?
Well, I'll to stick with Black and Native people, I think one thing we have to do is engage in a politics of decolonization and what you call self-determination. And what that would entail are finding new ways to create kinships and what we might even call new treaties between Black and Native people going forward and returning land. So often we talk about reparations for Black Americans, which I think might be a useful thing, but how can we talk about reparations? And I'm thinking here of the Ta-Nehisi Coates article, I think that came out in the Atlantic in 2014, but how can we talk about reparations without returning land to people? So it's going to require land to Native people. So it's definitely going to require building new treaties and relationships, understanding our shared histories and struggles and how we might move forward. And self-determination will require just that. It's going to require that Black folks really engage with understanding Native histories and also Native people engaging with the history of enslavement, which I don't think has necessarily been done very well yet.
And of course, Native Americans were also enslaved, not just by the Spanish, but by the English-speaking settlers as well. And that deep into the 18th and even 19th centuries.
Yes, that's correct. And that's an issue. And I'm glad you brought that up. People often talk about indigenous enslavement of people of African descent, but they were also enslaved as well, and many sold into the Caribbean. Some forced to go in the 18th century, 17th and 18th century, forced to go into slavery into Europe. And that's a history that is not often talked about, but also been a bit difficult to document. So that is a very good point.
And in fact, the Pilgrims routinely sold off to the West Indies those Native Americans that they didn't kill.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. And we definitely need more scholarship and work in that area to bring that to light for a general audience.
Tell us about some examples of indigenous and Black American collaboration.
I think one of the things forgotten in the mid-20th century in the Black freedom struggles and Native American struggles. So Dennis Banks, he did an interview in the Black Scholar in June 1976. And someone asked him, the interviewer asked him, who are his major influences? And he said Malcolm X, because Malcolm X was standing up for the liberation of Black people, but also all people. And I think just uncovering things like that is very important in telling the general public that these coalitions have existed and are very important going forward.
And yet there have been some stark separations in terms of the aspirations of the two peoples at certain times. For example, there were Black settlers in Oklahoma Territory who definitely wanted the land to be divided up into parcels so they could become landowning farmers. This, of course, in opposition to the Native Americans' aspirations for the land.
Yes, and that historian David Chang at the University of Minnesota has a fantastic book about that called The Color of the Land. But I'm always uncomfortable calling Black folks settlers, because while they migrated to here, that they did not, their ancestors did not come here to settle because of the history of enslavement. And so I think that's a fundamental thing that's very difficult to document, very difficult to sort of call Black folks settlers in that sense, because of the ongoing legacy of enslavement, even though it caused certain complications and they did want to become landowners. I think I'm not sure of another or a better term to talk about that. It has not yet been invented. But we should think about also the complications in Oklahoma in particular, because of the Trail of Tears and other migrations, there are complications between those indigenous nations who call Oklahoma their home now, but that was not originally their indigenous homeland. In fact, there are many tribal nations who call places home that was not their homeland, say, 1,000 years ago, for example. My people migrated from what we'd call modern-day eastern part of the U.S. and displaced other Native communities.
And looking out through those conference doors that you're at right now, what do you think the prospects are for the liberation struggles of oppressed people in the United States today?
It's going to be quite a challenge, especially if we don't deal with issues such as mass incarceration, which there are many activists trying to do, detention centers. It's sort of all connected, and it definitely should be a Black, Indigenous, Latinx, queer, and trans-led movement. And from there, we can sort of figure out what the issues are. Issues around water rights, climate change, and those things are all interconnected. So it's going to be tough, but we need people working at all angles in order to get collectively free. But we have to see that our struggles are not just separate, but our struggles are connected, whether you're Latinx, Black, Indigenous, and even white folks. We need everyone working on these issues together. And just the last point about ongoing struggles, I think fundamentally it still needs to deal with the issue of somehow returning land back to Native people, and that being a very central component of how liberation is going to work.
That was author and educator Kyle Mays at UCLA.
On January 1st, Brazil, the colossus of South America, with the largest Black population outside of Africa, will fall under the rule of Jair Bolsonaro, a racist and fascist by any definition. Bolsonaro was elected president after a long period of political chaos that saw the legislative overthrow of the left-wing Workers' Party government of Dilma Rousseff and the imprisonment of her predecessor, Lula da Silva. The United States has long sought to undermine the Workers' Party. We spoke with Alexander Main, Director of International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. He says Brazilians suspect the CIA had a hand in the defeat of the left and the rise of Bolsonaro.
Many people believe that they could well have played a role in the removal of Lula da Silva from the electoral equation. The fact that he was jailed on these dubious charges and prevented from running for president, thereby removing the strongest left-wing leader, the most popular left-wing leader, from the equation in these elections. And the U.S., certainly the U.S. Department of Justice, has been very involved in the Lava Jato or car wash investigation, anti-corruption investigations, led by this sort of fanatical judge, Sergio Moro. He's had a lot of contact with the Department of Justice, and they've been very involved in those investigations. And I think there are a lot of strong suspicions that there was political motivation behind some of the Department of Justice's so-called cooperation with the Brazilian judiciary, and particularly with this judge, Sergio Moro. Beyond that, we know in the past from funding that's gone to certain groups in Brazil over the years, and particularly funding, I think it was in the mid-2000s, that went towards support for a reform to the electoral system that actually was something designed, I would say, to marginalize the Workers' Party in future elections. And the U.S. government, through the International Republican Institute, funded by the U.S. Congress, helped support this. So this goes back way in the past, well, at least 12, 13 years ago, but it provides an indication from early on that the U.S. government was opposed to the Workers' Party. So, you know, we also see the fact that the U.S. government essentially supported the unconstitutional removal of former President Dilma Rousseff from power in 2016. She was impeached in a manner that violated the Brazilian constitution. Again, there were charges against her. There was no basis whatsoever to those charges, and they were actually dismissed by federal prosecutors. And yet she was removed all the same, and replaced by an unelected, very right-wing, very pro-U.S. government after that. It's been in place since then and is still in place today.
And of course, Barack Obama was president of the United States at that time. And folks remember that Rudolph Rousseff complained that the United States had bugged her and made a great diplomatic issue out of that.
Very true. So that actually links, I think, or could very well link to the Department of Justice's role in these Brazilian so-called anti-corruption investigations, where indeed there was a lot of tapping taking place by the NSA. So the NSA, indeed, the National Security Administration, was bugging President Rousseff. Perhaps more importantly, they were also spying on Petrobras. The Snowden documents that were released prove that. They were looking at Petrobras, and of course, Petrobras, the state oil company of Brazil, is where you had this corruption scheme that later gave way to these investigations. And so certainly the U.S. could well have been aware of elements that were used in the investigation after that and involved in that as well. It may be years before we have a better idea of the extent of the U.S.'s sort of covert involvement in all of this. And again, this very skewed, very politically oriented set of corruption investigations that implicated primarily leaders of the left-wing Workers' Party.
The MST, the Landless Peasant Organization, which is huge in Brazil. It engages about 2 million people, and it's the main force on the left, even though it doesn't run candidates for office. The leader of the MST admitted that the left had failed to work the grassroots during this time of crisis and leading up to the election, that they hadn't knocked on the doors, in his words, the doors of the poor people, and engage them in this.
Well, I think that is probably true. I think certainly not true for the MST. The MST has been incredibly organized and mobilized over these last few years, perhaps more than any other progressive force in Brazil. But the Workers' Party itself, I'd say, has been in disarray over the last few years. Once Dilma Rousseff was impeached, it's as if it sort of imploded, suggesting, I think, that there was big internal problems within the PT, within the Workers' Party, for a very long time. They were not structurally sound. They couldn't endure a very strong political blow. And I think this has to do with the fact that they were in power for a very long time and grew more and more disconnected, as this leader of the MST, João Pedro Stadile, suggests, more and more disconnected from the grassroots and from sort of grassroots organizing, which, of course, the Workers' Party was very good at for many years. They've been around since the 1980s and only came to power in the early 2000s. And through the 80s and the 90s, they were very effective in creating a strong, organized mass movement. But that mass movement clearly no longer existed once Dilma Rousseff had been removed from power. There was nothing there to really carry out any sort of effective resistance.
President-elect Bolsonaro has said he'd like to see a civil war in which 30,000 people might die. And he's said quite explicitly that he wants to make MST, the organization we've just been discussing with its 2 million engaged members, to designate them as terrorists. Are we about to see something on the scale of Argentina's dirty war or Pinochet in Chile?
Well, it's a very frightening time. He's made a lot of threats. We don't know exactly how he'll be once he takes power. Some people suggest that this is all bluster, that he likes to provoke and so on. I think those people could be very wrong, and I think that because when you look at Bolsonaro and his political career over the last 30 years, he has very consistently been an adamant defender of the brutal military dictatorship that Brazil had from 1964 until 1985, and consistently been a defender of torture, extrajudicial killings. Long ago, he said that the military dictatorship should have killed more people. And up to this very election, he said that his political opponents, those from the Workers' Party, and I think leftists in general, should be jailed or forced to leave the country. I think these are things that need to be taken extremely seriously. And yes, I think we can fear something similar to Chile and Brazil itself during the dictatorships in these countries. I think it's something that really merits the building of a strong solidarity campaign for Brazil going forward.
And it's almost silly to ask a question like, can we expect more police violence, especially in the largely black favelas? The police kill at least 3,000 people every year, and Bolsonaro has said that they don't kill enough to suit him.
Well, absolutely. No, I think we can expect worse than what we're currently seeing. We can expect much more military involvement. He's supported the militarization of Rio de Janeiro, which took place earlier this year, supposedly to try to diminish the violence, supposedly because the military would be more efficient than the police and so on. The result has been a surge in the number of extrajudicial killings that have been taking place in the favelas. That will no doubt continue, and on a much wider scale, given that Bolsonaro has said that he plans to militarize the entire country, to militarize its law enforcement. And this is both a huge threat to young black people throughout the country and also to activists more generally, who really, I think, will be seriously fearing serious repression on the part of Bolsonaro. He said he's going to do it. He's made it very clear that he wants to essentially go after activists, eliminate them. He's said that the majority should no longer tolerate minorities in Brazil, which, if he was really aware of the demographics of the country, maybe he wouldn't have said that, since the majority of Brazilians actually identify as being Afro-Brazilian or of mixed race. But clearly he saw the white inhabitants of Brazil as Brazil's majority, and that the minorities, both Afro-Brazilians, indigenous, mixed race, and so on, should become submissive, I would say, once again, to the white population in the country, just as was the case for so long in Brazil. Let's remember that Brazil was the very last country in 1888 to abolish slavery, and has never really had a civil rights movement, has very, very entrenched racism, extreme inequality to a large extent on racial lines. So he really wants to roll back the small amount of progress that we've seen in the last 20 years or so and bring Brazil back to its glorious white supremacist dictatorial past.
And the Amazon, which has been called the lungs of the world, and the people who live there, the indigenous populations, they now face Bolsonaro.
That's absolutely right. It's the indigenous and also the Quilombo, the Maroon communities. You have strong Afro-Brazilian Maroon communities in the northeast of Brazil that also have been granted protections, territorial protections, after, of course, having endured much of their land being usurped over the years. They have had protections in place, and Bolsonaro said he wants to get rid of these. He wants to open up these lands to mining and logging. And, of course, this will be extremely damaging, perhaps genocidal for these communities, and extremely damaging and destructive for the environment, and particularly the Amazonian region, which, of course, has the greatest biodiversity in the world, often referred to as the lungs of the earth. Well, he doesn't care about the environment, and he doesn't care about these communities. He does care about these entrenched interests that want to develop logging and farming and mining in protected areas, in the last protected areas of Brazil, just to make a profit.
That was Alexander Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington.
Fode Ajamu Mansere is a Black American Pan-Africanist, now living in Freetown, the capital of the West African nation of Sierra Leone. Mansere is executive director of the Black Star Action Network International, which includes many expatriates from the Black diaspora who've chosen to live and work on the continent. The Black Star Network's latest project is called the Be Clean Campaign.
The Be Clean Campaign is a campaign that BASANI, which is the Black Star Action Network International, as you said, it is a campaign that we have initiated here last year, October 2017, on the ground in Freetown, to combat and to raise awareness around the question of better sanitation and hygiene. We initiated it in reaction to what happened last year on August 14th, 2007, the tragedy known as the Mount Sugarloaf mudslide, whereas we lost thousands of lives, thousands of people lost their property and their homes. And BASANI was able to be one of the first responder grassroots organizations to get there, to hold the people. We did a number of interviews to get the word out to the international world about how we can assist and what was really going on the ground with that situation. Immediately after the mudslide, because so many bodies were washed out to the water, there was an immediate fear of cholera outbreak. And so immediately our attention went to the markets. It went to the dirty areas. We had already been involved here since 2013 as BASANI, organizing. We're a registered community-based organization here in Freetown, Sierra Leone. We are Pan-African. We would consider ourselves Garveyites in that we put our race first without any apology, without any compromise. You know, we're in Africa. We put ourselves first here. And, you know, we're just really pushing the organizing as well as trying to teach social entrepreneurship to people, how to connect, you know, their issues with the resources that they need in a real creative way. So that's why I say social entrepreneurship, because it's a creative way for people to earn or generate or raise the resources and the support that's needed from abroad. And so BASANI is an international entity that basically supports local grassroots initiatives towards development and improvement in Freetown. Since 2013, we had already been dealing with sanitation and hygiene. We had organized what you call community cleanups. Here they call them clean days, whereas you organize the people at the grassroots. We come together, we collect trash, we burn trash, we beautify the environment, we brush the cemeteries, try to repair the roads and things like that. It's the community labor, it's the community work, the voluntary work that we really are hands-on assisting the people in understanding how to do it in a better way. And so last year, last October, our response to this most recent cholera scare was to launch the Be Clean campaign and just tie it all together. We were here doing Ebola as well in 2014 and 2015. And of course, we had to also promote better hygiene and sanitation at that time as well. And so it has become an ongoing campaign of BASANI in Africa to push hygiene and sanitation. Hygiene-related illnesses, they claim more than 1.8 million lives in Africa each year, with 90% being children under the age of five. And it's very, very bad, particularly here in Freetown, because you have malaria. And malaria, you have a strong relationship with filth, with waste, and water puddles. So this is why we try to keep the roads without having the ability to gather water. That's why we try to clean the trash at the market. So last year, we initiated the Be Clean campaign, first with a large community cleaning of the local cemetery in the Calabar Town area of Freetown. Last year, this time, this country was in the midst of the historic political campaign, the elections, that has just landed the opposition party, the former opposition party, the SLPP, the Sierra Leone People's Party, into power now in this country. And they're coming with some very, at least on the surface, appearing to be progressive moves. You know, I've been here 5 years, so I've seen the last administration come to power, and I've seen this one come to power as well. And so it's amazing to see how differently the two parties are taking on their first few months in power.
That brings up a question. This Be Clean campaign is under the category of self-help, and certainly self-help is always laudable, but political work involves forcing the powers that be to fulfill their obligation in terms of social hygiene.
Yes, sir.
What kind of efforts are underway there?
Well, actually, when we started the Be Clean campaign, there was no cleaning happening anywhere in the country. other than, you know, maybe at small levels. So when we started the Be Clean campaign, it was in the midst of a very contested national elections here, and no one was doing it. So we decided that we would exert ourselves politically by organizing the community around an issue that we wanted politicians to pay attention to while they're competing with each other. And so we put the issue on the table. What happened was we were able to clean the community every last Saturday on our own in the midst of the campaign and make a lot of noise around it at the same time, to the point where we had one of three independent candidates who ran for parliament last year join us on our campaigning. He's a Pan-African brother named Kareem Ba. And we had just been utilizing the campaign to get the policymakers to see the issue. And so to our surprise, when the elections happened in March and the new administration came to power in April, the first act that the president took was to initiate every first Saturday is monthly cleanings. Now, of course, that's not going to keep the whole country clean throughout the month. But what it is a definite policy change towards hygiene and sanitation. That's saying that this administration cares about that issue. And we like to feel as though we played a contributing role to putting that out there at the right time, because as soon as it came to power, the first issue had become that. And when we first started our Be Clean campaign last year, there wasn't many people in the city doing that. And so it actually spread. Other people began to take control over their community markets and use the same campaign, the push. And so the Be Clean campaign, we actually foresee it becoming more of a coalition as well. And then even a company or a business collective, something that can spark employment and things like that. So we're looking at the government to give us an audience so that we can try to work with government to see what kind of collaborative efforts we can do to fulfill all of the potential within just being clean, man, just saving our lives.
It's difficult to imagine who would be against being clean, but has this work stirred up any kind of opposition politically?
Well, politically, our work hasn't stirred up any opposition at first, other than in the very early parts of going out in the community to organize. You know, there's community politics. Here in Africa, there's community politics that is not necessarily state politics. And just like in the Black community in the United States of America or anywhere else in the world where African people are, we have our communal politics. And the community politics around who has right to do what and who you have to ask first is very complicated in Africa, especially here right now in Sierra Leone, whereas we have almost 2 million people, over 2 million people within this one region of the country. Just to get a general idea over some of the things that we're looking at, this new administration is just bringing 9,000 new jobs. It's promised 9,000 new jobs in the next year. It's going to be 5,000 teachers, 3,000 medical workers, and 1,000 police. 70% of the nation is unemployed right now, with foreign aid reduced to over 40%, recently. And so we're dealing with 30% inflation. And this is one situation that's really going on, man, is these childbirths. It's a very big concern because one in every three girls between the ages of 15 to 19, they're either already a mother or they're pregnant right now. And so we're dealing with a crisis situation beyond health. And at the same time, we have to prepare for these children that's being born, these babies that's being born. We have to provide jobs for these young fathers, these young mothers. So Be Clean is not just about what we do physically to pick up trash from the streets. It's broader than that. It's really about us being clean in our moral character. It's about us being clean socially with one another, how we treat each other. And really, in terms of politics, it's about being clean in terms of corruption. Corruption is at the bedrock of the majority of the issues that we face here in Sierra Leone, just like everywhere else in the world. And this last administration that we've seen, they were one of the most corrupt that this country had ever seen. And people are very hopeful about this new government that at least is showing that it has interest in some of the issues that our people here really want to be on the table. 95% of Freetown's population currently is not even served by water supply utility. The entire city outside of the central business district is serviced by only septic tanks. The poor infrastructure and poor management of the roads is obvious everywhere you go in the city. So it's a very crisis situation. The Black Star Action Network International was created so that we can facilitate African unity in the 21st century. We were founded in Tampa, Florida in 2011. We were launched there in 2012. And since 2013, we have been based and headquartered in Freetown, Sierra Leone, where our movement has registered as a community-based organization. And we coordinate an international movement. We ask for the world to feel the pain of the child here in Freetown as well, and not forget that a little bit goes a far way here.
And how can people cooperate with you in alleviating that pain?
First of all, anyone who is looking to assist us, the Black Star Action Network International, you can go to gogetfunding.com/BeCleanCampaign. Again, I'll give it to you one more time. If you go there, there's a write-up. It's a brief write-up about who we are and what we do, as well as the links there for you to go ahead and make your donation and make sure that we can get the tools we need. We're able to provide the pamphlets that we need. We're able to get the prints that we need. We're able to really go hit the streets and continue this campaign and make sure that people don't slip on their sanitation and hygiene, and we keep it going. So again, www.gogetfunding.com/BeCleanCampaign. And our phone number for anyone who wants to reach us to get in contact, they're able to contact us at 919-435-2346.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.